Welcome to the Manufacturing Executive Podcast, where we explore the strategies and experiences that are driving mid-sized manufacturers forward. Here, you'll discover new insights from passionate manufacturing leaders who have compelling stories to share about their successes and struggles. And you'll learn from B2B sales and marketing experts about how to apply actionable business development strategies inside your business. Let's get into the show.
Welcome to another episode of the Manufacturing Executive Podcast. I'm Joe Sullivan, your host and a co-founder of the industrial marketing agency Guerrilla 76, where we help B2B manufacturers grow through revenue-focused marketing programs. When I hear the word service in any business setting, my mind goes straight to customer service. But the concept of serving becomes so much more powerful when it finds its way into all the other aspects of running a business as well. My guest today is here to talk about building what he calls a service culture. He'll talk about the importance of two-way communication, clearly articulating your organization's mission, and achieving universal buy-in throughout your organization around that mission. Let me introduce him. Fred Reggie brings 35 plus years of leadership experience across multiple industries. Fred fuses big company expertise with entrepreneurial agility, crafting practical strategies to drive your success. Fred's areas of expertise include mission, vision, values, executive leadership, service culture development, communication, and beyond business, a passion for giving back. Fred, welcome to the show.
Well, it's good to be here, Joe. Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you. And I'd love for you to kind of kick things off by just telling our audience a little bit more about yourself and your career path and how you wound up where you are today.
Well, Joe, I didn't realize this was going to be a three-episode podcast. So I'll try to be brief. You know, I've got a lot of territory to cover in, you know, in
we'll do the bio in episode one and maybe start asking some questions episode two and see where episode three takes us. I like it.
Hey, I think that sounds great. Thanks. No, I have a multifaceted history in work. My very first job, I was 10 years old. And it was a real job. I worked at a Dairy Queen in my hometown of Crowley, Louisiana. A friend of ours was the franchisee for Dairy Queen, and I begged him to let me have a job. So he hired me at the local Dairy Queen, which was completely different than the Dairy Queens you see today. It was basically a walk-up. You just walked up and placed your order in the screened window and whatnot. And I just loved it, making malts and sundaes and learning how to do the little curlicue on top. And I worked 6 days a week from 10 in the morning until 6 in the evening, 6 days a week for $10 a week back then. So it was child labor. It was abusive, but hey, we didn't press charges. But anyway, that's how I got my foot wet with really having an appreciation for business and being in business and doing things and serving and sales. You know, there was always an upsell. You know, would you like an extra scoop of chocolate sauce on that sundae and that kind of thing. That's how I got my feet wet. And I continued to work in the summers as a kid doing odd jobs. When I was in high school, I worked in a clothing store. I loved selling. One-on-one selling was always a big thing. And the first job I had out of college, oddly enough, I was assistant manager at Brennan's Restaurant in New Orleans, which is a world-famous restaurant. And that was really an interesting experience stepping into that whole service industry. And it resonated with me. And ultimately, down the road, it was something that stuck with me. And I opened my own restaurant for about 4.5 years here in Lafayette. But I've served in different industries. Of course, the restaurant industry, real estate development, and home building. My father and I were in business together for a while. And then I branched out, built houses for a while, until the market decided it wasn't a good time to do it. But I guess the most significant work that I've ever done that really has brought me to where I am today, and I say that because it's condensed all of those life and work experiences and channeled it into the way I approach business today. And oddly enough, it was in my work with St. Jude Children's Research Hospital. In 1988, I was elected to the national board of St. Jude, and I served on the board for 10 years. My father was privileged to be a founding board member of St. Jude, so St. Jude was always in our family history and in our family alignment. And I served on the national board for 10 years. And while I was serving on the board, of course, they expect you to do fundraising. And I began working in a fundraising arena where we built new homes and would raffle them off for $100 a chance. It was a program that had started in Shreveport, Louisiana. One of my fellow board members up there encouraged me to do one in Lafayette because I had a familiarity with the home building industry and the community here, et cetera, et cetera. So we did that. It was a first-time fundraising success for us. We raised about $600,000 the first year out of the gate. And to make a long story short, I wound up stepping off the board, thinking that we could grow this into a regional program for St. Jude, possibly do more dream homes in Louisiana and maybe Mississippi or some neighboring states. What started out as a whim turned into a 10-year enterprise for me, where I directed and developed the growth of this program nationwide. And when I left the program in 2006, that year we gave away 38 houses in 16 states and raised $26 million. And it's a program that continues today. And St. Jude gives away about 40 or 42 homes a year. That really set the stage. And you might say, well, how does fundraising set the stage for being a business coach? It really set the stage because my involvement with so many industries in the process, media, home building, real estate development, of course, volunteers, it put me in touch with a lot of different facets of business. And I got to see the workings and the gears that were moving in all of those respective industries. And there was an alignment. There was something that was similar, regardless of what the business was. And that was basically a service culture component. It was the way the businesses operated. The ones that we had the good fortune to work with were very much aligned with their purpose and with their mission. And it was an easy dovetail into what St. Jude Children's Research Hospital did. So when I left the organization in 2006, I decided to become a consultant, and I was going to be a consultant to the nonprofit industry, nonprofit world. I found early on that there were a lot of nonprofits that wanted to engage and they wanted to learn a lot, but sadly, they didn't want to pay for it. You know, it was not going to prove to be. This is no discredit to nonprofits, but I understand there. But I found that working in the corporate arena was a much better fit for me, given my experience in business over the years. So I began coaching, at doing executive coaching, team development coaching, and ultimately got very much involved with mission statement development with companies, because there seemed to be a void and a missing component in a lot of businesses when it came to really identifying what the purpose of the business was. That's what directed me and led me into the work that I do today.
Yeah, great background, Fred, and really cool what you've been able to do with St. Jude's in particular. You know, you don't fit the mold of my typical podcast guest who's spent, you know, a long career inside manufacturing, or might be, you know, somebody who's newer but bringing some kind of technology into the space. But the reason I wanted to have you on here is I think it's really good from time to time to bring somebody who comes from outside of that space, who has experiences in other places like restaurants and nonprofits. And I think the idea of service culture is what's kind of stood out in our previous conversation to kind of set up this. And that's really what I'd love to talk a lot about today. And so I think from here, what I'd love to hear from you, you know, when you and I were talking a week or two ago to kind of prep for this conversation, you mentioned that you had adapted the tagline that your father used in his business, which was a service-based business, which I believe was "We serve to serve again," if I'm not mistaken. And I'd love for you to kind of talk about that and unpack the meaning of that and why it's so important to you.
the story about my father was a Lebanese immigrant who came to this country at 5 years old in 1920. And when he was 18 years old in the height of the Depression, 1933, he opened a service station. We grew up in Crowley, Louisiana, which is a small community near Lafayette, where I currently live, maybe a population of about 5,000 people at the time. And my father opened a Sinclair service station. He had letterhead printed. I mean, if you can imagine that, that in itself is kind of mind-boggling to think back to 1933. An 18-year-old would have letterhead for a service station, but he did. It was Reggie's service station. And a few years ago, probably about 20 years ago, I came across some letters that my dad had written to my mother. She would go to Shreveport, Louisiana in the summer and visit relatives, and she'd spend maybe a month there. And my mom and dad were courting at the time. And as I always say, for those of your listeners who don't know what courting is, it was the swipe right and swipe left of the day. And so they would exchange letters and keep posted on what was going on in Crowley and how she was doing up in Shreveport, et cetera. And those letters were handwritten on my dad's stationery. And I had read several of those letters. And it wasn't until after maybe four or five readings that I noticed under his letterhead was a tagline. And the tagline was, "We serve to serve again." And that was something that really stuck with me, Joe. It gave me an understanding of who my father was and what I had recognized in him. He was not someone who was in business he didn't want to serve you as a one-off, okay? He was always looking for the future engagement with his customers, future business in the moment. So he wanted his customers to know that while he may be putting gas in your car today, he'd like for you to come back, certainly for more gas, but also to do an oil change or to get new tires or a battery or a tune-up, whatever the services were in those days that were provided by service stations. And that stuck with me because I witnessed my father throughout his life, and it really all members in my family were oriented to that. They served to serve. They were always in service to other people, whether it was in the community, whether it was through the church, or just in social situations. So I decided to adopt that motto as an homage to my father, but also to embrace that and keep a mind awareness that I'm in business to serve people over and over again. I want to play it out. If you and I are engaged and you've contracted with me to provide a service to you, that's fine. I don't want that to be the end. If there are other opportunities where I can help you, where I can serve you and serve your business, let's talk about it. I want to behave in the moment with the anticipation of having more business down the road.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's kind of a mindset, seeing that tagline, even for yourself, to being in front of you all the time, to think this is about me and having, you know, future business and, you know, recurring customers. But it also is just as much for the customer, if not more so, right? Like, you need a great customer experience to bring that person back. And if that can be your mindset, you know, you're creating a business model where everybody's going to win. So I think it's really great.
Sure. And I mean, you know, if we go back to my experience as a home builder, my experience in the restaurant industry, it was always for a referral for other business. Or certainly if you came to my restaurant, I didn't want that to be your only visit. We wanted you to come back over and over, and we wanted you to bring your friends and your relatives and let it be a center of celebration for the evening or for that lunch meeting or whatever.
100%. Fred, I've heard you use the term service culture leadership more than once in a previous conversation, as you know, we've gotten into this conversation. Tell us what that means and why that is such an important thing about, you know, the way you coach business leaders.
You know, Joe, when we hear the word service, when we hear the word service anything, we think of customer service. It's that interaction, that person-to-person interaction. Sometimes customer service is, we might equate that with a desk at Target where you return merchandise that you weren't happy with, or it didn't fit, it just wasn't the right thing. Or if you have a complaint, you go to customer service. And it's really the one-on-one engagement. Service culture, on the other hand, is understanding the purpose of the business and letting that purpose serve as the compass that guides all of the decisions, your approach, your planning to your business, your interactions with those customers. What I like to say is customer service is the face of the business. Service culture is its soul, because that's really, service culture is the organic component of business. It's really what drives everything on a day-to-day basis. And of course, customer service is one of those things that it drives. But if you don't have a strong service culture and understanding that you're there, you're serving to serve again, then the direction can kind of go into a number of different points. So it's service culture. Leadership is where the leadership in any organization, from the CEO all the way down to the lowest level, understands what that mission is and understands that, hey, this is our culture. This is who we are. This is how we are expected to interact with our customers. This is how we are expected to interact with one another. Let's not forget there are internal customers as well as external customers. And sometimes the internal customers get overlooked, the people that we work with on a day-to-day basis. And that's where the leadership component comes in to direct that interaction across all departments and across multi-levels within the company.
So, you know, sounds great in theory. It's a great concept. I'm on board. But what are some ways that that service culture leadership can actually play out, help our listeners, you know, make that a little bit more tangible in their minds, maybe?
Well, to make it more tangible, I think you really have to kind of do an assessment and understand what your purpose is. As you mentioned earlier, I do a lot of work in the areas of mission statement development and vision development for companies and values. And it's going to those moments when those documents, if you will, are created, that they're created from an internal standpoint and they become organic rather than having a board, for example. And this, I see this a lot, where a board will come up with a mission. They'll have a board retreat and they come up with a mission statement for the company. Then everyone in the company gets a copy of it, or they'll put it on the wall on a plaque and a poster. And okay, this is the mission statement. And the people in the company have really played no role in the actual development of that mission statement. What I do when I conduct retreats, mission statement retreats, we get players from every level and all departments within the company to come together, and we break them out into teams. There's a process that we go through where we'll have as many as six teams working on developing a mission statement, and it's a full day retreat. What comes out of that is something that employees take ownership of, because they've had a voice in creating it. It's not something that's been handed down. Learn it. Most people couldn't tell you what the mission statement of their company is, because a lot of times it's too long and drawn out, and it doesn't really state the purpose of the business, the reason for the company's existence. You know, Joe, when I conduct these retreats, the first question I ask people who are participating, if your company evaporated tomorrow, meaning never existed, okay, what does the marketplace lose that can't be replaced? What can't be replaced? What do you have here functioning as a unit, a collective body that functions as a unit, just like a football team or sports team? Okay, what is missing? Because you can put together 20 people to create a business just like yours, but there are different 20 people. There are different 20 people, there's a different mechanism, and the mission of that company is going to be slightly different than what it is today. So it's, let's identify what's unique. What can we promise to the public? What promise can we make and live up to that we can promise to the public? Then you develop your mission statement. That's your purpose. And from that, you create your vision. Well, okay, this is who we are. Where do we want to be in the next 3 to 5 years? And you create a vision statement for the growth of the company. How do you want to see this company flourish and develop over the next 3 to 5 years? And by doing that, you have a shared vision. And shared is the operative word here. If everybody's not on board with that objective, with that vision, it's not going to be effectively accomplished. One of the illustrations I use frequently when I'm conducting these retreats and we talk about a shared vision, I talk about the shared vision of the Beatles. And here you have four extremely talented musicians in their own right. They were spectacular, okay? But coming together, they formed a unit, and they had to have a shared vision if they were going to achieve what they wanted to achieve. And their shared vision was to be bigger than Elvis. That's what they were setting out, because Elvis was the main attraction. They were coming into the United States. They didn't want to just provide music. They wanted to be the recognized go-to when it came to rock and roll. And they wanted to be bigger than Elvis. And in 5 years, they became bigger than Elvis. Had they not focused on that, they could have each gone in different directions, different paths. They could have argued, and they had their own internal strife and arguments, but it was always working towards that shared vision. And I encourage companies to establish a vision that everybody buys into, not just something that's dictated to everybody in the organization, but something where everyone plays a role in it, and they understand what their role is.
Okay, let's take a quick break here. I want to let a couple of our strategists at Guerrilla 76 tell you about something pretty cool that we're doing right now for marketing folks in the manufacturing sector. Peyton and Brendan, take it away.
So I'm Peyton Warren.
And I'm Brendan Forrest.
Twice a month, we host a live event called Industrial Marketing Live.
Right now, we have a group of 50 plus industrial marketers from a variety of manufacturing organizations that meet up digitally to learn, ask questions, network, and get smarter.
Every session has a designated topic, and one of our team members at Guerrilla 76 opens up by teaching for the first half hour or so. Topics have included how to do a better manufacturing webinar, getting started with paid social on LinkedIn, how to optimize your website for conversions, creating amazing video content, and so much more.
After we break it down, we open it up to Q&A so we can help you apply all of this in your own businesses.
This is pure value, no cost, no strings attached, no product or service pitches, just a 100% unadulterated learning experience.
And on top of these live sessions, we've also opened up a Slack channel where attendees bounce ideas off each other and learn together between sessions.
We're building a true community of manufacturing marketing professionals here. So if you or someone at your company has the word marketing in his or her job title, please consider telling them about it. They can visit industrialmarketinglive.com to register.
We'd love to see you there.
Yeah, I really like your Beatles analogy there. I think that's a great way to think about how you could be creating that shared vision inside the company. I think where I want to go next in this conversation is to talk about conversations. I think that you have a mission, you have a vision, communicating that out throughout the organization feels like the next step. You know, we deal with this in our own company, and my business partner, John, who you know, and I both, you know, we're co-leading of a 35 person company, and we run on EOS, which I talk about from time to time here, Entrepreneurial Operating System, and have our VTO, our Vision Traction Organizer, is our 2-page business plan. And we've got, you know, our elements of what you'd call a mission and vision statement baked in there. You have core values baked in there. You have a 3-year picture and a 1-year target and quarterly rocks we're working towards. And it doesn't work unless we're communicating this out regularly, that people understand where the company's going, what we stand for, why all this matters. And I think that's one of the challenges is like, you go through, we revisit this quarterly, right? But how do you make sure that in that 3-month period between this quarter and next quarter, we're continuing to reinforce where the company's going and all the pieces of that? So would love to just kind of open that back up to you. And I know you've also got a book about productive conversations and communication. So take this where you'd like. But I think that idea of a leader being a great communicator and using communication to drive home the mission is such an important thing.
Yeah. And let's remember, communication is a two-way street. It's not just the leader issuing directives, but getting feedback and feed forward. You know, how do we become better? What are you seeing in your department? What are you seeing at your level in the business? Where can we tweak it? Because let's face it, you know, the buck stops here, as they say, and it can be very isolating to be up in the executive tower, and you don't always hear what needs to be heard. You don't know how things are developing. Sometimes, if they're not developing right, it's too late. It's too late to fix, or it gets to a crisis mode. So all along the way, you have to have effective decisions. Your service culture has to continually evolve. And in order to do that, you have to have interactive communication with all of your departments, all of your employees. Make your employees feel valued in the process by asking questions. And look, you don't have to always take their advice. But, you know, if I came to you and say, Joe, I think we can do a lot better in this arena. What are your thoughts about it? Tell me how you would approach it differently than we're approaching it now to improve it. And you may be three or four levels below that leader, below that executive, but the fact that you're brought into the conversation helps you take some ownership. It gets you thinking about the business in a different way. And I think it's up to leaders to trust the people who work under them and serve to serve again. You know, trust them, get their input. You don't have to take every recommendation or every piece of advice, but it all fits into the overall picture when it comes to the decision-making process. And that's one of the areas where I see a lot of businesses fall short on both ends. People who report to executives or to leadership roles, they are very hesitant in a lot of cases to come forward because they think their idea is stupid, or they don't have any value, or they don't know how to lay it out. They don't know how to initiate that conversation that could bring by some tremendous changes in the company for the better. But they remain dormant, they remain silent because they may feel intimidated. They may have been intimidated by that leader. So in the leadership role, we have to be very conscientious of the weight that we carry as leaders and how it might influence the response of some of the people who work for us. So open door policy, let's have regular meetings. Where one of my clients with a Fortune 500 company was kind of frustrated because they would have weekly meetings with his team members and they would try to flesh out ideas, but they never really caught on. There didn't seem to be any cohesiveness. So I said, let me ask you, describe the meeting room. I said, well, we sit at a conference table and, you know, we take notes and we contribute. I said, do you have a whiteboard in the room? So he says, yeah. I said, do you ever use the whiteboard? He says, no. I said, why don't you do this? When you have a discussion and Joe says, well, you know, I think we can, hey, Joe, wait, before you say that, go up to the whiteboard and write down your thoughts, write down your ideas. So they started doing that and they got much more active participation among the team members. And the results of those meetings were much more productive than they had been prior to that. And I think when you elevate someone's contribution as significant, they're going to do whatever they have to do for the next meeting. They want to make sure that they come up with another great thought idea so they can map it out, do a little mind mapping on the board and come up with a solution. And again, it's a collective effort that everyone buys into because they've taken ownership. They've had a voice in it.
Brad, tell us a little bit about your book that is on the horizon.
Whenever I take on a new client, I'll always ask them to list three things they'd like to work on immediately during our engagement. And one of the three usually is always some area of communication. They're frustrated with how they communicate or the fact that certain people are not communicating. And over the past several years, I've noticed that they don't know how to initiate conversation. They admit to me, you know, I don't know how to walk into someone's office and start a conversation, especially if it's a critical conversation. I don't know how to do it. Or they will say, sometimes we may be at a company function and we have some executives there. I don't know how to have a small talk conversation with them. We can talk about business, but that only goes so far. But I'm uncomfortable in that space of initiating conversation. So this is a throwback, and I'll tell you how I came up with this. I tell them, I said, write down two words. If you don't learn anything, write down these two words. Tell me. Tell me. You want to initiate a conversation with someone, start with tell me. You know, tell me about your vision for the company. Tell me about your family. Tell me how you got started in this business. Tell me about your favorite vacation spot or the last great vacation. Tell me, tell me, tell me. Tell me is not a question. It's a directive. And you are issuing a directive, and you're setting the stage for someone to talk about their favorite subject, themselves. And in the process, you become a more active listener. Because you're committed to this conversation now. If I'm telling, you know, I can say, what do you do, Joe? And you can tell me, and I may tune you out before you're even finished. But if I say, Joe, tell me about your work and how you got involved in this, then I'm obligating myself to be an attentive listener, to be an active listener to what you have to say, because I want to create an exchange. I want you to tell me more. So that's prompted me to begin writing a book that I'm hoping to have published in about the next 3 months. And if you can guess the title of the book, it's called Tell Me. The way I came about that is an interesting story. About 35 plus years ago, I was watching the CBS Evening News. That's when you had about three news stations back in those days. And so I watched the CBS Evening News, and the news crew was covering a Broadway show that had just opened. There was no fanfare. There was no orchestra pit, no fancy set. There were about 12 or 15 chairs lined up across the stage. In those chairs were some older, senior, seasoned actors who had been around for a long time. They were passing the microphone back and forth, talking about their experience in the industry, whether as a stage performer or a movie actor. How did you get started? Who were your mentors? So it was a very lively discussion. After the show, the film crew went to the rear stage door to capture some of the actors coming out. And I can see this like it was yesterday. To the left of the camera view, there were three older women standing, waiting to catch a glimpse of one of their favorite actors. Out of the backstage door comes James Earl Jones. We all know who James Earl Jones is, a famous Darth Vader in the voice of CNN and a tremendous actor. And James Earl Jones walked out. One of these women just broke away, and she rushed up to him and she said, "Oh, Mr. Jones, you're my favorite actor. I've seen you on Broadway and in the movies, and I love your CNN voice." And she just was showering him with all of these accolades. And he turned to her, Joe, and he just had the kindest look and a smile on his face. And he extended his hand to her and he said, "Tell me your name." And Joe, that was something that stuck with me. You know, here's a guy who was being celebrated in the moment, and he pivoted and he went to this woman and he said, "Tell me your name." It was like, I want to know who you are. He didn't say, "What's your name?" or "Who are you?" Tell me your name. And in that moment, that's something that resonated with me. And from that moment forward, I never did ask someone, you know, "What's your name?" or "Who are you?" I've always said, "Tell me your name." And "tell me" has become a very, very effective form of initiating conversation and maintaining productive conversations, because you're listening for what the other person is saying and you're able to respond. You're able to elicit more information from them. Tell me more. You know, that's the three words that follow, right? And so the conversation becomes very productive. People, look, this is Dale Carnegie. I didn't invent this. This is Dale Carnegie 101. 1936, Dale Carnegie wrote How to Win Friends and Influence People. And he says, you can get other people to spend 80% of the time speaking, and they think you were the greatest conversationalist they ever met. So how does that tie in with business? You can walk into someone's office, "Tell me about this. Tell me your thoughts. Tell me what you think about this," and immediately initiate conversation that really is productive. People feel valued. When someone directs you to tell them something, about yourself, about your work, about a decision you made, then you feel valued. You feel like what I have to say is important. That's something that I find missing in a lot of businesses, especially when businesses scale up, is it's that person-to-person, make people feel valued at the human-to-human level, not just in the KPIs and the metrics. See who they are as people.
Powerful couple words there. It's really interesting, like just hearing you say them to me, how different it feels than just asking a question, right? Like starting that out, like opening yourself up and saying, I'm here to listen, basically, is what that communicates to me, which sets a different tone.
Yeah. And it's productive in a professional setting, a social setting, and a family setting. The funny thing about it, whenever I work with clients and I give them the tell me spiel, we'll call it, okay, they immediately put it into practice. Where? When they go home. They'll try it on their wife or their children. One of my clients, the next time we met the following week, he says, Fred, before we start, I have to share with you what happened last week. After you and I met, I decided to try the tell me thing on my daughter, who's 14 years old. Usually, I'll say, how was school today? And she'll say, oh, it was fine. It sucked, whatever. She goes into a room and I never see her again for the rest of the night. I decided to try the tell me. She's walking through the room. I said, Jane, tell me about your day at school. He says, Fred, she stopped. She turned around. She came and sat on the sofa next to me, and we had a 15-minute conversation. And I don't want to oversimplify it, but it's simple. It's simple, and you just have to step into that space and try it.
I love it, and I'm going to try it on my 9-year-old daughter, and I think it'll work just as well. Well, Fred, you know, this is a really great conversation. Is there any parting advice you'd like to leave for manufacturing CEOs, owners, lead, or anybody in a leadership position inside of our audience, or, you know, anything I didn't ask you about that you'd really like to add to this conversation?
Well, one of the things we talked about before that you had asked about was the younger generation coming in and the difficulties. I mean, admittedly, there's a big communication divide. And I think, and again, I don't want to be the old guy in the room, but I think technology has created an isolation and an insulation from person-to-person interaction. And it's so easy to get comfortable in that space where, hey, I can text someone or I can send them an email or I can ignore them rather than engaging in conversation. And I would just say, push it, you know, reach into that space. If you're a leader in a company and you have a lot of Gen Z employees that you find withdrawn because, hey, look, they would be happy spending their life, a lot of them, with their laptops open, getting their work done. I'm not saying they're not productive. They're very productive in what they do. They're very intelligent. They're not conversation because they grew up in an environment where their parents most likely were pretty much victims of technology as well. So there wasn't the family interaction. I grew up in a family of storytellers. I grew up in a family where we'd sit on the floor and we'd listen to people, especially coming from a family of immigrants. You hear stories about, you know, the old country. You hear stories about some of the other immigrant families that came, and they were all told in story form. It wasn't just bullet points. I can still see my uncles and my aunts actually getting into character when they would talk about some of these people, you know. And yeah, you know, he was hunched over when he walked and he talked, you know. So they created a visual in the conversation. And what I suggest to all of my leaders, whether you're CEO or senior level management or supervisor, is that step into that space and have a conversation with people. You don't know what you're going to find out. You don't know what doors are going to be open when you have a conversation. And when you're outside of the workplace, there are opportunities that are just swirling around, but you have to create a conversation to discover. They're not going to just land in your lap. You never know what's going to happen. And I mean, I could do a whole podcast episode with you on experiences and things that have popped up just through a simple conversation. Well, you know, well, who do you know? Do you know this person? And before you know it, a conversation ensues, and there's some great benefit that comes out of it. Not that it's self-serving, but it's like a nice surprise. And not just business, but in a social setting. You know, you meet people that you establish a relationship with that otherwise would not have.
I love that, Fred. Great way to wrap it. Really good conversation. Tell me how our audience can get in touch with you and learn how you might be able to help them. You see what I did there?
Yeah, I will.
I'm just practicing.
There you go. Well, they can email me. My email is simple, fred@fredreggie.com, or they can connect with me on LinkedIn. That's the easiest way. And I don't ghost people. Okay, that's another conversation as well. But I respond, so send me an email if you have a question. If you'd like to set up a 10-minute visit, we can do a 10-minute Zoom call. I'd love to hear from you. And Joe, I want to thank you for giving me this opportunity to be on the show.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I really enjoyed the conversation, and I love when I get to walk out of here with something that I can put to use right away, and I know what that'll be.
Great.
Beautiful.
Thank you for that.
Thanks. Absolutely. Well, thanks for doing this, Fred. Really, really appreciate you being a guest.
Thank you, Joe. It's been a privilege.
As for the rest of you, I hope to catch you on the next episode of The Manufacturing Executive.
You've been listening to The Manufacturing Executive Podcast. To ensure that you never miss an episode, subscribe to the show in your favorite podcast player. If you'd like to learn more about industrial marketing and sales strategy, you'll find an ever-expanding collection of articles, videos, guides, and tools specifically for B2B manufacturers at gorilla76.com/learn. Thank you so much for listening. Until next time.